And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
The Earth is changing, and we humans are tethered directly to the currents of change. A recent study puts into graphic form the state of the world's oceans. And what do they show? That's coming up, as well as the weekly Earth Summit and Nature News, when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Well, here's the good news. Daylight Savings Time is scheduled to begin this Sunday. I've always welcomed that change in the spring. To me, it's like getting a new car. But it's funny, really, in that all we've really done is moved our perceptions a bit. But what a difference it makes. Suddenly, there's so much more time, and the day seems so much longer. Well, to a large degree, that's what today's show is about. Taking note of the differences a change in perspective can make. In segment two, we change our perspective on the oceans with the publishing of a new report out of UC Santa Barbara that helps us literally see the oceans as we have not been able to before. And following the weekly Earth Summit, which begins in just a moment, we get caught up on this week's Nature News. But first, I'm sure many of us can't understand why we can feel so passionate about our Earth while others seem not to give it a second notice. And within that statement lies the key to the paradox of compassion, which we turn our attention to now with the weekly Earth Summit. Welcome to the Weekly Earth Summit, the most important 15 minutes on Earth. I'm your host, Sydney Wildsmith, and today we hear from Dr. Daniel Goleman, who wonders why, although we are likely hardwired for compassion, yet too often we overlook it. So now, please welcome Dr. Daniel Goleman.
There was a very important study done a while ago at Princeton Theological Seminary that speaks to why it is that when all of us have so many opportunities to help, we do sometimes and we don't other times. A group of divinity students at the Princeton Theological Seminary were told that they were going to give a practice sermon, and they were each given a sermon topic. Half of those students were given as a topic the parable of the Good Samaritan, the man who stopped the stranger in need, to help the stranger in need by the side of the road. Half were given random Bible topics. Then one by one, they're told they had to go to another building and give their sermon. As they went from the first building to the second, each of them passed a man who was bent over and moaning, clearly in need. The question is, did they stop to help? The more interesting question is, did it matter they were contemplating the parable of the Good Samaritan? Answer, no, not at all. What turned out to determine whether someone would stop and help a stranger in need was how much of a hurry they thought they were in. Were they feeling they were late? Or were they absorbed in what they were going to talk about? And this is, I think, the predicament of our lives, that we don't take every opportunity to help because our focus is in the wrong direction. There's a new field in brain science, social neuroscience, that studies the circuitry in two people's brains that activates while they interact. And the new thinking about compassion from social neuroscience is that our default wiring is to help. That is to say, if we attend to the other person, we automatically empathize. We automatically feel with them. They're these newly identified neurons, mirror neurons, that act like a neural Wi-Fi, activating in our brain exactly the areas activated in theirs. We feel with automatically. And if that person is in need, if that person is suffering, we're automatically prepared to help. At least that's the argument. But then the question is, why don't we? And I think this speaks to a spectrum that goes from complete self-absorption to noticing, to empathy, and to compassion. And the simple fact is, if we are focused on ourselves, if we're preoccupied, as we so often are throughout the day, we don't really fully notice the other. And this difference between the self and the other focus can be very subtle. I was doing my taxes the other day, and I got to the point where I was listing all of the donations I gave, and I had an epiphany. It was, I came to my check to the Save a Foundation, and I noticed that I thought, boy, my friend Larry Brilliant would really be happy that I gave money to Save a. Then I realized that what I was getting from giving was a narcissistic hit, that I felt good about myself. Then I started to think about the people in the Himalayas whose cataracts would be helped, and I realized that the phenomenology of what was happening to me was that I went from this kind of narcissistic self-focus to altruistic joy, to feeling good for the people that were being helped. I think that's a motivator, but this distinction between focusing on ourselves and focusing on others is one that I encourage us all to pay attention to. You can see it at a gross level in the world of dating. I was at a sushi restaurant a while back, and I overheard two women talking about the brother of one woman who was in the singles scene. And this woman says, my brother is having trouble getting dates, so he's trying speed dating. I don't know if you know speed dating. Women sit at tables, and men go from table to table, and there's a clock and a bell, and at 5 minutes, bingo, the conversation ends, and the woman can decide whether to give her card or her email address to the man for follow-up. This woman says, my brother's never gotten a card, and I know exactly why. The moment he sits down, he starts talking nonstop about himself. He never asks about the woman. And I was doing some research in the Sunday Style section of the New York Times, looking at the backstories of marriages, because they're very interesting. And I came to the marriage of Alice Charney Epstein, and she said that when she was in the dating scene, she had a simple test she put people to. The test was, from the moment they got together, how long did it take the guy to ask her a question with the word you in it? And apparently Epstein aced the test. Therefore, the article. Now, this is it's a little test I encourage you to try out at a party. Here at TED, there's great opportunities. The Harvard Business Review recently had an article called The Human Moment about how to make real contact with a person at work. And they said, well, the fundamental thing you have to do is turn off your BlackBerry, close your laptop, end your daydream, and pay full attention to the person. There was a newly coined word in the English language for the moment when the person we're with whips out their BlackBerry or answers that cell phone, and all of a sudden we don't exist. The word is pizzled. It's a combination of puzzled and pissed off. I think it's quite apt. It's our empathy, it's our tuning in, which separates us from Machiavellians or sociopaths. I have a brother-in-law who's an expert on horror and terror. He wrote The Annotated Dracula, The Essential Frankenstein. He was trained as a Chaucer scholar, but he was born in Transylvania, and I think it affected him a little bit. At any rate, at one point, my brother-in-law, Leonard, decided to write a book about a serial killer. This is a man who terrorized the very vicinity we're in many years ago. He was known as the Santa Cruz Strangler, and before he was arrested, he had murdered his grandparents, his mother, and five co-eds at UC Santa Cruz. So my brother-in-law goes to interview this killer, and he realizes when he meets him that this guy is absolutely terrifying. For one thing, he's almost 7 feet tall. But that's not the most terrifying thing about him. The scariest thing is that his IQ is 160, certified genius. but there is zero correlation between IQ and emotional empathy, feeling with the other person. They're controlled by different parts of the brain. So at one point, my brother-in-law gets up the courage to ask the one question he really wants to know the answer to, and that is, how could you have done it? Didn't you feel any pity for your victims? These were very intimate murders. He strangled his victims. And the strangler says, very matter-of-factly, oh no, if I had felt the distress, I could not have done it. I had to turn that part of me off. I had to turn that part of me off. And I think that that is very troubling. And in a sense, I've been reflecting on turning that part of us off. When we focus on ourselves in any activity, we do turn that part of ourselves off if there's another person. Think about going shopping. Think about the possibilities of a compassionate consumerism. Right now, as Bill McDonough has pointed out, the objects that we buy and use have hidden consequences. We're all unwitting victims of a collective blind spot. We don't notice and don't notice that we don't notice the toxic molecules emitted by a carpet or by the fabric on the seats. So we don't know if that fabric is a technological or a manufacturing nutrient that can be reused, or does it just end up in landfill? In other words, we're oblivious to the ecological and public health and social and economic justice consequences of the things we buy and use. In a sense, the room itself is the elephant in the room, but we don't see it, and we've become victims of a system that points us elsewhere. Consider this. There's a wonderful book called Stuff, the Hidden Life of Everyday Objects. And it talks about the backstory of something like a t-shirt. And it talks about where the cotton was grown and the fertilizers that were used and the consequences of the soil of that fertilizer. And it mentions, for instance, that cotton is very resistant to textile dye. About 60% washes off into wastewater. And it's well known by epidemiologists that kids who live near textile works tend to have high rates of leukemia. There's a company, Bennett & Company, that supplies Polo.com, Victoria's Secret. They, because of their CEO, who's aware of this, in China formed a joint venture with their dye works to make sure that the wastewater would be properly taken care of before it returned to the groundwater. Right now, we don't have the option to choose the virtuous t-shirt over the non-virtuous one. So what would it take to do that? Well, I've been thinking, for one thing, there's a new electronic tagging technology that allows any store to know the entire history of any item on the shelves in that store. You can track it back to the factory. Once you can track it back to the factory, you can look at the manufacturing processes that were used to make it, and if it's virtuous, you can label it that way. Or if it's not so virtuous, you can go into any store, put your scanner on a palm onto a barcode, which will take you to a website. They have it for people with allergies to peanuts. That website could tell you things about that object. In other words, at point of purchase, we might be able to make a compassionate choice. There's a saying in the world of information science, ultimately everybody will know everything. And the question is, will it make a difference? Some time ago, when I was working for the New York Times, it was in the 80s, I did an article on what was then a new problem in New York. It was homeless people on the streets. And I spent a couple of weeks going around with a social work agency that ministered to the homeless. And I realized, seeing the homeless through their eyes, that almost all of them were psychiatric patients that had nowhere to go. They had a diagnosis. What it did was to shake me out of the urban trance where when we're passing someone who's homeless in the periphery of our vision, it stays on the periphery. We don't notice, and therefore we don't act. One day soon after that, it was a Friday, at the end of the day, I was going down to the subway. It was rush hour, and thousands of people were streaming down the stairs. And all of a sudden, as I was going down the stairs, I noticed that there was a man slumped to the side, shirtless, not moving, and people were just stepping over him, hundreds and hundreds of people. And because my urban trance had been somehow weakened, I found myself stopping to find out what was wrong. The moment I stopped, half a dozen other people immediately ring the same guy. And we found out that he was Hispanic, he didn't speak any English, he had no money, he'd been wandering the streets for days, starving, and he'd fainted from hunger. Immediately, someone went to get orange juice, someone brought a hot dog, someone brought a Subway cop. This guy was back on his feet immediately. But all it took was that simple act of noticing. And so I'm optimistic. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Goldman. I wish to add a footnote to Dr. Goldman's wonderfully insightful talk. I'm intrigued by the image of mirror neurons, cells in our brain that respond to similarities between two individuals, what many researchers are attributing as the source of our empathy and ultimately compassion. There are so many examples, but one that I think really points this out, which we've all experienced, is to come across someone who is sad. Think about what happens. I think I speak for many when I say that there's a flash of connectedness where we ourselves feel sadness, but ours is empathic. Our voices soften, our bodies soften, our hands reach up to console. We speak directly to the person and ask them, "What's wrong? Is there something I can do?" These empathic and sympathetic reactions are likely honed, something that develops within us with experience, and as well can become overwhelmed, as Dr. Goldman points out so clearly in his examples. But it makes me think of the importance of developing compassion in children, exposing them to the gentleness and wonder of our world, letting them experience firsthand the happiness of animals and their friendship, getting them close to creatures so that their eyes meet and the mirror neurons respond. And part of the paradox I sense in this is that in our world, there are literally fewer and fewer animals, fewer birds and crickets and frogs and foxes. And therefore, children may be growing up with a diminished sense of compassion for life. So as we gain an extra hour of daylight, help children you know take the time to notice. This is Sidney Wildsmith inviting you to join us next week for the most important 15 minutes on Earth, here on the weekly Earth Summit. A brief reminder, I'm beginning to launch the Wildside News on YouTube with the Wildside News Update. When the Great Spirit moves me, I'll be offering my commentary on things I'm passionate about. Check it out regularly by going to YouTube and type in Wildside News. See you there. And speaking of news, here's this week's Nature News. Oil set a new record price of over $104 per barrel, driven to a large degree by prices in the commodity markets. The nation needs now to get used to these new benchmarks, which are not likely ever to lower to any significant degree. And the already pressed American consumer needs to get ready for $4 per gallon gasoline this year and the general rise in prices of virtually everything. This historic high price for gas is driving a sudden surge in innovative transportation design, with car makers across the board putting hybrids and now even talk of hydrogen-powered vehicles into the mainstream of life. And that's the good news. Missiles are being exchanged between crews of Sea Shepherd's Steve Irwin and the captain of the crew of the Nishan Mara, the Japanese whaling ship trawling for specimens for their research in the whale sanctuary off the southern shores of Australia. Members of the 33-man crew of the Steve Irwin tossed bottles with rancid butter and a super slippery chemical onto the deck of the Nishan Mara while verbal missiles were broadcast back to the Steve Irwin from a loudspeaker on the Nishan Mara, with a woman's voice saying, "This is the captain of the Nishan Mara," and the subdued barrage continues. As yet, the two vessels have maintained a respectable distance from one another, unlike years past when the vessels actually collided. Sea Shepherd Captain Paul Watson continues his efforts to disrupt the operations of the Japanese research fleet in waters deemed sacred for whales. Both sides are appealing for support from the Australian government, within whose waters these battles rage. We will be following this story as it continues to develop. Environmental extremists are being blamed for the destruction of 5 showcase homes in Woodinville, Washington, which were willfully set ablaze by arsons. The Street of Dreams was about to open and was being promoted as a more eco-friendly site, based on a reduction in size and use of more earth-friendly materials. The Pacific Northwest appears to be a focus of various attacks by groups loosely allied as ELF, the Earth Liberation Front. Signs spray-painted with those initials were at the scene of the blaze. A series of trials have taken place and are currently being adjudicated, in which individuals are being prosecuted for similar arson crimes and association with ELF. ELF claims that to date no one has been hurt or killed as a result of their actions. Most environmentalists agree that such actions ultimately do more harm than good in the efforts to bring about change. Montana has announced a wolf hunting season for the fall. Hunters will be given permits to hunt and kill wild wolves, but not with the aid of helicopters, scents, traps, or poisons. This historic hunting season is contingent on the removal of wolves from the endangered species list, which is expected to take place by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service this Thursday. The state has chosen to set a wolf season based on the estimate of 447 wolves in the state, a number they argue could easily withstand a limited hunting season. Opponents of Montana's decision state that there is not enough research that has been done on the effects wolf hunting may have on the stability of wolf families and packs. The decision is expected to be challenged in the courts, which could postpone the opening of the wolf hunting season for years. Scientists are predicting a collapse of West Coast salmon runs again this year. Last year witnessed a decline to one-third the expected populations of Chinook salmon in the Sacramento River. Changes in ocean currents appear to be the cause, as these currents are responsible for a condition called upwelling, which stirs up waters from the bottom up and in the process initiates the growth of phytoplankton and zooplankton upon which the oceanic food web relies. The same condition in previous years led to the death of thousands of seabirds from starvation, as the oceans were lacking in the usual amount of food for fish and fowl. This year, however, may bring back a more normal dynamic of winds and sea currents, which would invigorate a return to more normal conditions. And that's the news. If you have a news feature, send it to the Wildside News at wildsidenews@cox.net. That's WILDSIDENEWS at COX.NET. In just a moment, we head on out to Santa Barbara, where a newly released study on the status of the world's oceans makes things abundantly clear that the oceans around the world are indeed going through change. That's coming up when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wildside News.